Blog Talk Radio.
Because the system is rigged. Now the system has to bloody start to change. Because it's locked.
incredibly. But instead, the majority trotted along to vote because they said, well, if you don't vote for them, they might get it. It doesn't matter! They're matched on the same face! So what if they get it? Same thing will bloody happen.
Now, we just showed a report comparing Libya to the former Yugoslavia exactly 12 years ago. What do you make of all this?
Well, it just keeps going on and on. Any excuse that the United States has to attack another country, they just make it up. It's not about a humanitarian crisis. And besides that, it's a civil war, and it's none of the United States' business. Here, they're talking about the Republicans and the Democrats, about balancing the budget in the U.S., as they're just blowing away probably $1 billion in a week, bombing another country. How about fixing up Detroit, whose population has declined from 2 million to about 700,000? How about fixing Camden? Now, this is just war, and war's a wreck.
To send war troops to the war in Afghanistan, Barack Obama in Norway to receive his Nobel Peace Prize awarded in October. Republican Congressman Ron Paul says Obama's recent war plans show he shouldn't have been awarded the Peace Prize.
He should have returned it down. I mean, he's expanding the war, and the people should be embarrassed. I mean, how can you believe in preventive war? That is, belief in the principle of starting wars and expanding wars and get a peace prize. I mean, I don't see any signs of peace. I see that the world is more dangerous. It was more dangerous the last administration, and the danger continues to expand with this administration.
More and more people killed through war, killed through bombing attacks, killed through shootings, killed through lack of food and adequate medical care. Gaza, the most crowded piece of land on earth, is little more, ironically, than a concentration camp. And the world looks on. We've been totally misled about what it is. Rothschild dynasty created Israel. It paid for the first people out of Europe to go and people Israel after the war. It paid for the building of the Knesset. It paid for the building of the Supreme Court building with all its Illuminati symbols all over it. And some of the people who've broken out of the family, and quote one of them in my book, have actually said, and as I've been saying for years, because it's bloody obvious, that Israel is not the homeland of Jewish people. It is the fiefdom of the Rothschild dynasty, created out of Rothschild Zionism, a secret society. And Rothschild Zionism has been used via Israel to devastate, slaughter, torture an entire nation of human beings while claiming to be against terrorism. We've got to go for that. I mean, and people, Jewish people, have seen it. They can see what it is. There's some fantastic Jewish people in Israel who are resisting this. Young people who go to jail because they won't serve in the army because of what the army's doing to the Palestinians. Magnificent people. Never get talked about in the mainstream media, hardly.
I mean, in terms of what's going on now, what's your assessment of what Israel is doing in Gaza?
I can answer you with two words: a war crime. My government is now engaged in a massive war crime, killing hundreds of innocents. It's not just a war crime against the Palestinians, it's a crime against the Israeli people. And on behalf of thousands of Israelis that are demonstrating right now in the streets of Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, and in many other places, with Palestinians, with internationals, people from all kind of backgrounds and all parts of the Israeli society are completely, completely ashamed and against this crazy assault. We know that you cannot kill, as Jewish people, we know that you cannot kill the desire of people to be free. As a Jewish person that was raised on all these values of liberation and humanity and freedom, we cannot kill the desire of the Palestinian people to live in freedom. And on behalf of those people in Israel and in the world, I want to call the international community, the Jewish community in the world, and everyone that listens to me now, please join our force to stop this massive people are dying right now. The rockets, by the way, can kill also me and my parents when we work in the south, not far from Gaza. But it's crazy that my government, at the same time that people are being killed on our side, is continuing this crazy assault, thinking that they can kill the desire of millions of people to be free.
But the argument your government has, Tzvi Livni, was saying that it's extremists responsible, a small number granted, but every rocket that's fired out of Gaza into Israel must be stopped, and this is an act of defense.
Yeah, and the Palestinians will say the same thing. This is an act of defense. They are being trapped in this open air prison for decades, and they cannot eat, they cannot have the medicine, they cannot go in, they cannot go out. We lock them there in a big ghetto, and we have to put the words in a very clear context. We are locking this 1.5 million people for so long, and we treat them as animals. And this is the result.
What are the changes that could be interpreted as a materialization of the popular demands there?
Well, I think that we need to reach a point now in history where we realize that this war on terror is a war of terror, and everybody who plays a role in that so-called war on terror is in fact a collaborator with American imperialism and the denial of human rights. I believe, personally, but it's not up to me. It's us as people, not just the Egyptian people, all of us, because we're all connected. Everyone stands to gain by the success of these revolutions in the Middle East, and everyone stands to lose if these revolutions fail. So we must make sure that the people's will is respected. And the only way that it will be respected is by the very same thing that we're seeing right now, and that is that governments have started to fear the people. Only when governments fear the people do they actually do what we demand that they do. Otherwise, they do all the same old things that they've been doing in Egypt, which torturing people, imprisoning people, killing people. I believe that everything should center around our rights, a Bill of Rights, human rights. Everyone has rights, and don't you dare tell me that you're going to provide me security, but you have to take away my rights. No, we have rights, and don't you even think to take away those rights. And I believe that should be the center of all of our movements. Every single person shall be respected. And until such day that every single person on this planet is respected, there will never be justice, and for damn sure there will never be peace. The only way we're going to have peace is when we have justice. So we must demand justice, and they must be willing to die if necessary. And I want to say love and respect to all the revolutionaries out there. I want to say love and respect big time to the military who have put down their weapons. And if you need to, if your commanders are ordering you to kill the people, then maybe you should turn your weapons on those commanders.
You just referred there in
your
comment. Yeah, you just referred there in your comment. What do you think the Arab uprising is about? And we're speaking about the Israeli lobby, about the United States, their concerns. Will they be able to, in the protest, the word hijack these uprisings?
Well, yes, if the people do not continue to maintain the pressure, continue to do what they're doing. Let us not rest easy. Let us not listen to the words restraint or calm. Let us be resolute. Let us be determined. And let us never give up. I myself know that the powers that be are desperate. The Israeli Zionist project, the American imperialist project, is on its knees. It is trying everything it can to try and maintain the system of power that has put people through hell for decades and decades. And if we do not stop, if we do not give up, we can succeed. And the whole planet, all people will succeed if we do manage not allow the tyranny to continue. And I must say one last thing. Palestine. That's where we're going ultimately. Palestine must be free. There is no question about that. It is at the heart of all injustice. So let it happen sooner rather than later.
I think he's right.
I do too. I mean, that's the last one. This one here, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Oh, speculation drives the food prices as bankers gamble on hunger.
Yeah, this really
put
the bug on it for me. This is they're protesting this in England, but they should be protesting this everywhere around the world. Speculators are driving up the price of food. And we've seen that with Coffee Boy. Do you want to read that?
Yeah, the speculative scrum driving up food prices. Bankers, hedge funds, and sovereign wealth funds are gambling on hunger by speculating on the food supply. Global regulators should step in to stop them. Last year, the price of global food floated high as ever. That's bad news for most of us, but not for those who trade commodities. In fact, 2011 was a great year for the traders who thrive on bad news, currency woes, drought, flood, freeze, fire, and all the manifestations of imminent apocalypse. 2011 was a wild ride. One spring morning, cocoa futures dropped 12% in less than a minute. Corn ascended to all-time peaks, and sugar fluctuated more in one day than it used to in a month. Howard Schultz, CEO of Starbucks, rallied against speculators in coffee, while Pepsi Company forecast its own medium-term commodity cost increases to exceed $1 billion, all of which meant a bumper crop for the world's commodity exchanges. Even those that used to be backwaters, like the Kansas City Board of Trade and the Minneapolis Grain Exchange, both of which recorded their highest electronic trading volumes in history. It was a volatile year, and the volatility posed problems for the food industry. Faced with high-stakes game of price-shifting basic ingredients, the world's largest food processors and retailers put on a call for mass PhDs and economic modelers to theorize and implement even more complex risk management strategies just so they could keep up with the second-by-second spikes and dips of grain and livestock futures. In the meantime, high-frequency traders and momentum-driven hedge funds made it their business to speculate on food.
There are plenty of ways to get in on the action, but as an increasingly complex amalgam of food-based commodity derivatives piled one on top of the other, the more difficult it became to perceive what it was that lay at the bottom of the speculative scrum. What drove the global food market in 2011, other than those old faithfuls, fear and greed? It put in a call to Professor Yanir Bar-Yam of the New England Complex Systems to see if he might have an answer. Nessie, based in Cambridge, draws on fields as various as math, physics, and computers and so on. It's a little yada, but prices have been way out of the equilibrium in 2011, Barham told me. The bubble has not burst yet.
Let's go down to the conclusion.
Yeah.
Nothing influences financial regulators like equations, so the reforms we can look forward to in 2012 will ultimately depend on the numbers, which is a mixed blessing. One reason people don't want to understand the math is the deafness of those who are making the money, said Bar-Yam, but the old mathematics is manifestingly wrong. So all this speculation is, it's just gambling, and it hurts the people who don't have, the poorest people in the world.
Yeah, and this is kind of an important paragraph, though. This guy, this professor, said that he believes that time has come for global regulators to step in and manage the global market. Their first task would be to guarantee transparency and make public information previously shrouded in secrecy, such as the who holds the biggest stakes in global commodities, transparent accounting practices would have made the disappearance of $1.2 billion worth of customer money from the books of MF Global less a matter of sleight of hand and more of a matter of international crime. So, you know.
And the second part of the speculation solution hinges on a return to traditional position limits in commodities. Limits enforced by international laws geared to stop bankers, hedge funds, and sovereign wealth funds from going long on the world's food supply, in effect, gambling on hunger. That's disgraceful.
Yeah,
that is a bunch of sick people.
Yeah.
All driven by greed.
Yep.
And that was from The Guardian.
And oddly enough, it's supported by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but you know, The Guardian, but it says the Poverty Matters blog. So they get donations from Bill and Melinda Gates. Just thought you might want to know that. All right. And let's go to this. Britain, richest beggar. Oh, Britain, the IMF and the world's richest beggar. We'll just do this quick. Euro rage is reaching a new height over Britain's latest outrage. A refusal to pony up a further $31 billion and £31 billion rather. We can't afford to problem a monetary union that was created against our wishes and better judgment and launched with a malevolent purpose of excelling the great leap toward a European state that is inherently undemocratic. It is being presented as treachery, Anglo-Saxon perfidy, and naked pursuit of national interest.
What's the rest of that article?
Well, it's turning the Britain...
Well, the British never wanted to be part of that.
And Greece and all these other countries.
Well, they kept the pound.
World's biggest beggar, it says. So, yeah. Hang on a second. Let me just point out, the UK never agreed to such commitment in the first place.
That's joint going with the euro.
Right. And the line was written into the December 9 summit communique in an attempt to bounce Britain into handing over the money.
The UK does not consider the rescue machinery to be a remedy credible as constructed. The Eurozone...
Very remotely credible.
You're right. The Eurozone has the means to tackle its own debt crisis if it is willing to use them. These include fiscal pooling and the mobilization of ECB. I'm not sure what that is. European Credit Bank?
Something like that. I don't know.
As European politicians never tire of reminding us, their aggregate debt levels are lower than those of the UK, US, or Japan. They are right. So get on with it and stop begging. Euroland is, of course, entitled not to deploy Eurobonds or the ECB if these mean a breach of the German Constitution, violate the ECB's mandate, but that is entirely their choice. Both their Gründergeist and the ECB mandate can be changed. It was the EMU members who created the dysfunctional currency. They are now trying to shift the consequences of their errors onto others, rather than taking the minimum steps necessary to fix the problem at the root. If they are unwilling to save the EMU by serious action, leur physical union, they should organize an orderly breakup. The UK is willing to back up more funds for the IMF, but only in line with our IMF quota and proportionate to other members around the world. The UK budget deficit is dangerously high, again, as critics never tire of pointing out. Eurolanders want it both ways. They bask in their fiscal superiority, yet they demand an external rescue. Excuse us, benighted little Englanders, if we cannot quite see things their way. The Eurozone rescue does not in any case deal with the cause of the crises, which is the
intra-EMU currency.
Misalignment between North and South. I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, I'm not either. You've got to be European for this. It merely perpetrates a deformed system that is draining the lifeblood out of half of Europe. I always feared that Britain would somehow be blamed for the demise of monetary union. My signature is coming true, or my nightmare, rather, is coming true. And that was by...
Ambrose Evans Pritchard.
Yeah, and from the Telegraph. So, that's the guy there.
Yeah.
So, anyway. Interesting, huh? Doesn't count. Fox News. If Ron Paul wins Iowa, it doesn't count, says Fox News. You gotta love this, right? You gotta love this bullshit.
But if somebody else wins.
Oh, if anybody else wins, it counts. But if Ron Paul wins, it doesn't. Let's go on with this.
Ron Paul now, according to a public policy polling, is within 1 point of the lead in Iowa, right? So now that it looks like for the first time Ron Paul might actually have a shot at winning Iowa, all of a sudden the establishment has changed their mind on how important Iowa is. Remember, before it was like, oh, the Iowa caucus, whoever wins the Iowa caucus, that's the real deal, that's the most important thing. Obama won the Iowa caucus, and then that gave him momentum, and he won the whole thing. All right, so Chris Wallace, tell us what the new memo from the establishment is on Iowa.
If Ron
Paul
wins here, what then? The Ron Paul people are not going to like my saying this, but to a certain degree it will discredit the Iowa caucuses, because rightly or wrongly, I think most of the Republican establishment thinks he's not going to end up as the nominee, so therefore Iowa won't count and it will go on.
Come on, come on. So now you're telling me that before you were telling me Ron Paul had no chance of winning. I thought Ron Paul, what a kook, what a crank. He's not going to win, Ron Paul. Oh, he's going to win? Well, then it doesn't count. If he wins Iowa, what we were previously telling you about how important Iowa is, forget that. Now Iowa is irrelevant. Because by definition, if Ron Paul wins something, then it no longer matters. That's what they've been saying about all the straw polls that he won. He won, like, 18 different straw polls. And as soon as they're like, oh, who's going to win the straw poll in Iowa? Oh, my God, who's going to win it in California? Oh, Ron Paul won it. No longer matters. Do you ever hear about any of the straw poll wins of Ron Paul? Almost never, right? Because as soon as he wins, like, yeah, but it's not right because he has more followers. You know, it reminds me of what where we got that saying of the young church being too strong, right? It's when we won this online poll for who should get the 10 o'clock show on MSNBC. And one of the other people in the poll said, yeah, but it's not fair. They have more viewers. Yeah, it's not fair. They're too strong. So I know what they're saying, that Ron Paul does not poll well nationally, but he's got fervent supporters who are grassroots, who can win these things, whether they're online or they're caucuses, et cetera, right? But that's how Obama got momentum. That's how he won the presidency. He did it in a caucus in Iowa, and then the caucuses during Super Tuesday were critical to Obama's victory. But now when people are talking about, hey, you know what, Ron Paul doing the same thing that Obama was in those Super Tuesday caucuses as well, they're like, yeah, but it doesn't count. No, it's maddening. It's maddening. And honestly, there's a word for it. Bullshit.
That was Young Turk. And he used to be on MSNBC. But
till they kicked him off.
I think it was mutual. He couldn't stand lying, he said, anymore. He says, because they just, you know.
He couldn't say anything that were
yeah,
true.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Guy has credibility then.
Yeah, I think so.
And honor.
Yeah. And here's another one of Ron Paul. Another one, the panic of the puppet masters. People are starting to get worried. I mean, he's only one point away from Romney right now.
He's ahead in one poll.
He's ahead in one poll. That's great news, you know. A second, I'm just trying to get to this full article here so I can read it. Small blogs there's a problem sometimes. But anyway, it says from America's Journey. It's a blog. It says the panic of the puppet masters. America has often been described as a sleeping giant, and the term refers to the tendency of most Americans to get along with their lives, leaving politics to those drawn to this dog or pony show, paying their taxes and letting the babies have their candy. That is, until the baby's antics become so out of control, out of touch, and downright dangerous to their very existence that they can't help but notice that something is very, very rotten. Then everybody wakes up, takes a look at the problems, at the options available to solve those problems, then gets involved. Yes, that's very true. And the media circus that has been the Republican battle for nominee for president in the coming elections is rapidly causing concern for the puppet masters that have been sucking the blood out of the Americans for a long time. Hard times, poverty, radical moves to burn the Constitution, wars based on lies, with more coming based on even more lies, and loss of property, TSA, Nazi tactics, media complicity and manipulation of America's world news, worldview, and many more things have become such threats to everyone's future, and they are paying attention. And as they look at options available to solve root cause, they turn to Ron Paul.
I had to do a lot of driving today and turn on the radio to stay awake. All that available is the standard right-wing crap from the usual suspects. You know the names. But today they brought out their pundits of the puppets to convince their flock of gullible suckers that Ron Paul doesn't matter. To convince their audience that Ron Paul can't win, first of all, that's bullshit. Otherwise, they wouldn't be forced to discuss the subject. But there is something else afoot, my friends. Ron Paul is the real deal. Two constitutionalists with the utmost respect and rock-solid record can demonstrate that he means what he says. And that is exactly what makes him so dangerous to the blood-sucking, looting, suckers looting our nation, leading us into phony wars, continuing the phony war on terror, the phony war on drugs, the campaign to take your firearms, the selling out of our nation. The bloodsuckers know that Ron Paul will take immediate action to stop their party. And when their party, stealing everything you have, stops, your life will change for the better very rapidly. The other thing afoot I mentioned is this. The Republicans and Democrats have all been bought and paid for, controlled by the same banks to cabal, looting our nation via the Federal Reserve's crooked banks and moral wars. This became obvious when they passed the National Defense Authorization Act, also made obvious by this undermining of everything America stands for, was the sound of one hand clapping by the mainstream media remaining silent while this treasonous law was passed. I've heard somewhere that silence is agreement.
The puppet masters are scared shitless that they recognize that Ron Paul will win. So what will they do? Their next stratagem will be to split the Republican vote so that the election is thrown to Obama. Why? Because Obama, Gingrich, Santorum, that dumb witch, the rest of them except for Ron Paul. But since the banksters and warmongers own both parties, meaning those venal office holders who lost the moral compass they took an oath not to lose, that Obama will do just as well as any of the usual puppets.
Don't fall for the bread and circuses. Ron Paul is the real deal. Do everything you can to prevent the stealing of his election, the lying in the media about his positions, the attempts by the media to sideline him, and remember that Ron Paul will save this nation. We are at a dangerous crossroads. Ron Paul is our best hope at this time to steer us back in the right direction, the direction of peace and prosperity and liberty we all long for. There are no more sides in politics anymore. There really is only one side, the side of the Constitution, the side of liberty and justice for all.
Yeah, and you can check that one out. Yeah, I wrote it. That was a good article. That's The American Journey.
America's Journey.
Americans.
American's Journey.
American's Journey. It's a blog.
Must be a blog, huh?
Yeah, so that's a Blogspot blog. And let's see, go on. And I thought that was pretty good, didn't it?
Yeah. Jonathan Turley.
This is a little long, but the President Obama just stated that he can have any American citizen killed. And, that's the George Washington University law student, law professor. I don't know if you want to play just a few minutes.
Yeah, let's play a little bit of that. Sometimes easier to take rather than trying to read those things.
Yeah, but we'll do a few minutes of this one. Washington Journal.
Washington Journal continues.
Jonathan Turley is law professor at George Washington University Law School. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also has the blog jonathanturley.org, a legal blog that goes over lots of issues that are in the public eye, what's going on in the legal world and their implications. You had a piece in the Washington Post recently called, "Are You Being Watched? It's Your Fault." What does that mean?
Well, what is often neglected in today's particularly presidential debate, but in the overall debate in the country, is that we have something of a crisis with regard to privacy. This country used to be distinguished, used to be defined by privacy. We have an innate sense of privacy that you haven't seen expressed in other countries to the same extent. Even close allies like England really don't have the historic commitment to individual privacy that the United States has had. But what has happened in a very short time is the erosion of privacy in this country to the point of a crisis. I mean, we're fast becoming a fishbowl society. I mean, when you came here this morning, when you left your home, you were filmed on the roads driving to the highway, on the highway itself. If you stopped for coffee, you were filmed in the parking lot and in the 7-Eleven. And then you got back in and you were surveilled all the way to work. And when you got into work, you were surveilled inside your building. Most people's businesses now have video cameras that run continually. And you work in that environment. Keep that trip. And Americans are now used to being under surveillance all the time. When I teach privacy at George Washington Law School, there's a big sign in all that says you are under surveillance. and I teach privacy with that sign right above my head. So the question is, what's happening to our society? What type of citizens are we producing when they grow up learning to expect, even be comforted by, continual surveillance?
I wanted to read the last paragraph of this piece you wrote. It says, the problem is not with the government, but with us. We're evolving into the perfect cellophane citizens for a new transparent society. We've grown accustomed to living under observation, even reassured by it, so much so that few are likely to notice, let alone mourn, privacy's passing.
That's right. And my students have a fraction of the privacy expectations that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And their children are likely to have even less. What we're not really discussing is what happens to a society of cellophane citizens. What happens to a society where we expect, even want to be under surveillance? That's a completely different paradigm from what the framers believed was essential. What I think people often miss is that the Constitution does protect privacy to a small extent, but not very much. What really protected privacy in the United States was the inability of the government to actually engage in surveillance for a lot of times. It would be technological limitations. Those technological limitations are now gone. The government actually can engage in surveillance that the framers would never have imagined. And it's coming at a time when people are no longer focusing on the loss of privacy because they're not used to having much privacy in the society.
You dig into the case Jones versus the United States before the Supreme Court, which involves GPS tracking and putting a GPS tracker in the vehicle of a suspect. Take us through your concerns about this case and what you think the implications are.
Well, it's perfectly Orwellian. In fact, that's what Justice Kennedy said during oral arguments. He basically said, well, let me get this straight. And this is the Obama administration, is saying that we should be able to put GPS devices on any citizens without a warrant so that we can follow them 100% of the time, know exactly where they're going. And Justice Kennedy said, isn't that pretty Orwellian that you'll be able to do that? And the Obama administration's argument is basically citizens have no expectations in terms of their traveling in public, even with a device that shows every turn, every second that they make. And that's the reality. It's strange, but we have a cycle, like a 40-year cycle, where our privacy doctrines break down, and we need a correction. The best example of that was in 1928, in a case called Olmstead, the Supreme Court created a truly ridiculous doctrine called the trespass doctrine. And that doctrine said that the government only needed a warrant if they physically trespassed on your property. Well, that, of course, is bloody ridiculous, because what it did, it was actually one of the cases where the Supreme Court actually forced technological changes. And so the market of surveillance immediately went to non-trespassory surveillance devices. And so the Supreme Court actually pushed the industry into developing ways to engage in surveillance that didn't involve trespass, things like laser window pickups and parabolic mics. Well, the trespass doctrine was a huge failure. The government engaged in massive amounts of surveillance. Then in 1967, the Supreme Court handed down Katz, which is a very elegant decision. And Katz was the decision that said famously, the Fourth Amendment protects people, not places. And that's really great. I mean, it really captures the moment. But the test they created...
No, and why is that important? Break that down for us.
Because that trespass doctrine treated your home, the physical outline of your home, as what's being protected. But that was ridiculous. What's really being protected is what the home represents, what's within it, privacy. And so the Katz court handed down a test that was really a major step forward for privacy, but it had within it its seeds of its own destruction. Because what the Katz test said is that the government would now require a warrant to engage in surveillance whenever you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Well, here's the problem. That means that as your reasonable expectations of privacy fall, the government's ability to engage in surveillance increases. And as it increases, your expectations fall. And you have this downward spiral, which we're in today.
Yeah.
Most of my students have very little expectation of privacy outside their immediate home or apartment. And that means the government has much more ability.
Do you think that the case that's now before the Supreme Court, Jones versus the United States, could be as significant in these privacy issues as Katz was, as the earlier law was?
It could. It's coming around at the right time, as we're on the 40-year mark again, and the court could correct its past problems. The problem that we have is that this is not the court to do it. This is a very conservative court. There's not a lot of privacy advocates on this court. It is the problem that many libertarians have with the conservative movement. As many of the justices are conservative, they're not libertarian in the sense that they tend to vote for the government on police and surveillance programs, and they tend not to vote for individual rights on things like privacy.
Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington University Law School. Here's how you can join the conversation. Republicans can call 202-737-0002. Democrats, too.
That was a good explanation.
Yeah, there was more to that, and it's probably worth listening to, but I wanted to get to a couple other things. But it tells you we don't have...
Well, it's interesting that he said his students expect less privacy. I had a discussion with some students the other day about bullying and meanness in classrooms and corridors. They wanted to have cameras going all the time to control that.
That's what your teachers wanted?
No. This is the kids.
Well, the kids wanted that.
Mm-hmm. They don't have an expectation of privacy like we do.
No, you know.
They're used to it. We have cameras certain places, but they think they should be everywhere.
But they're used to Facebook. They're used to YouTube. They're used to everything. And so,
well, that's what he's saying. There's no expectation of privacy.
And what people want is, or what people of this generation seems to want more than any, a lot of them, but probably the last couple generations, is celebrity, you know? And if you're a celebrity, you don't have any right to privacy, very little, which they find out, because even if they do, I mean, privacy they have, the less famous they are.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? If you're put up on a YouTube video, but
I understand what you're saying, Leo, but it's a little bit of digression from the point.
But it seems that that's what has been pushed more. I mean, everybody wants fame and fortune. You know what I mean?
And the price for that is to lose your privacy.
To lose your privacy, right? And what's happening is they're not getting fame or fortune. They're just losing their privacy.
Right.
You know, and they're getting imprisoned.
I understand what you're saying, right. but the point was this discussion was about bullying and protection.
Oh, that's kind of interesting.
So they're willing to give up
just like the United States
the privacy to have what they perceive as protection.
That's what they did after 9/11. They gave up their they did the Patriot Act, gave up their rights. And still giving up their rights to protect them from Al Qaeda, which
I didn't give up my rights. I didn't agree with that.
Which never existed and doesn't exist. You know, it's just amazing, huh?
It's all phony baloney.
Creepers, man.
But he's right. Kids today have, and because of what you said about the desire for being a celebrity, they don't see anything wrong with the lack of privacy.
Yeah, not at all.
They don't see the reason for it or the need for it.
And this has been a problem for a while, and there's been a lot of speculation about this. I'll just read this briefly, because NATO versus Syria, World War III.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah, there's been a World War III scenario that seems to be, you know, that's why they're going after Iran, and they're going after Syria, and they're trying to bring out Armageddon. NATO is already clandestinely engaged in the Syrian conflict, with Turkey taking the lead as U.S. Proxy. Ankara's foreign minister, Ahmet, has openly admitted that his country is prepared to invade as soon as there is agreement upon the Western allies to do so. The intervention would be based on humanitarian principles. To defend the civilian population based on the responsibility to protect doctrine that was invoked to justify Libya. Turkish sources suggest that intervention would start with the creation of a buffer zone along the Turkish-Syrian border and then be expanded. Aleppo, Syria's largest and most cosmopolitan city, would be the crown jewel targeted by liberation forces.
Mm-hmm.
And unmarked NATO warplanes are arriving at Turkish military bases close to Iskenderun on the Syrian border, delivering weapons from the late Muammar Gaddafi's arsenal, as well as volunteers from the Libyan Transitional National Council, who are experienced in pitting local volunteers against trained soldiers, a skill they acquired confronting Gaddafi's army. Iskenderun is also the seat of the Free Syrian Army, the armed wing of the Syrian Council. And French and British special force trainers are on the ground assisting the Syrian rebels, while the CIA and U.S. special ops are providing communications, equipment, and intelligence to assist the rebel cause, enabling the fighters to avoid concentrations of Syrian soldiers. So, and you know, they're all trying to, they're trying to go for another, they're trying to go crazy, yeah.
Yep.
So,
return of debtors' prison, thousands of Americans are jailed for not paying their bills.
Let me just go to that, because I think that was quite interesting. There was a story yesterday about a woman who was arrested. Think Progress Justice is the blog.
Federal imprisonment for unpaid debt has been legal in the U.S. since 1833. It's a practice people associate more with the age of Dickens than modern-day America. But as more Americans struggle to pay their bills in the wake of the recession, collection agencies are using harsher methods to get their money, ushering in the return of debtors' prisons. NPR reports that it's becoming increasingly common for people to serve jail time as a result of their debt because of sloppy, incomplete, or even false documentation. Many borrowers facing jail time don't know they're being sued by creditors. Take, for example, what happened to Rhonda Sanders in Illinois. She was driving home when an officer pulled her over for having a loud muffler. But instead of sending her off with the warning, the officer arrested Sanders and she was taken right to jail. That's when I found out I had a warrant for failure to appear in Marcopian County, and I didn't know what it was about. Sanders owed $730 in a medical bill. She says she didn't even know a collection agency had filed a lawsuit against her. A company will often sell off its debt to a collection agency, generally called the creditor. The creditor files a lawsuit against the debtor requiring a court appearance. A notice to appear in court is supposed to be given to the debtor if they fail to show up. A warrant is issued for their arrest. More than a third of all states now allow borrowers who don't pay their bills to be jailed, even when debtors' prisons have been explicitly banned by the state constitutions. A report by the American Civil Liberties Union found out that where people were imprisoned, even when the cost of doing so exceeded the amount of the debt they owed. Sean Matthews, a homeless New Orleans construction worker, was incarcerated for 5 months for $498 of legal debt, while his jail time cost the city six times that much. Some debtors are even forced to pay for the jail time themselves, adding to their financial troubles. Stories of surprise arrests for unpaid debt have been reported in states including Indiana, Tennessee, and Washington. In Kansas City, one man ended up in jail after missing only one furniture payment. The Federal Trade Commission received more than 140,000 complaints related to debt collection in 2010, and they've taken 10 debt collection agencies to court for their practices in the past 3 years. Since the start of 2010, judges have signed off on more than 5,000 arrest warrants since in nine counties alone, Beverly Yang, a legal aid attorney, says many debtors and judges don't know debtors' rights, which results in the accused being intimidated into a payment agreement. She's seen judges interrogate debtors about why they can't pay more and whether they are trying hard enough to find a job. Yang says some collection agencies are only too eager to use needless, harsh tactics. Whatever the creditors or the creditors' attorneys can do to leverage some kind of payment, it will help the profits enormously because they have literally millions of these. Debt collection is a lucrative business. The industry is set to grow 26% in the next 3 years. No kidding.
Yeah, incredible,
though. Sick. Let's see what states were... More than, go here, where it says more than a third of all states, see if that...
See
what states are doing that. Let's see if there's a list. Go down.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a list. If you go down to the end of this. Of the article.
Yeah, hang on a second. Stuck here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
it's just
Washington
about,
State was one of them.
Yeah. Oklahoma.
Illinois.
Indiana.
Vandenberg, yeah, Vandenberg County.
Indiana.
Yeah.
It didn't give a list. I thought maybe
some of it. They just said 13 states, but they didn't say which ones they were. So, but anyway.
Sorry, we couldn't give you that list,
that,
folks.
But anyway, that let's go to. Flu shot fantasy, other influenza vaccines help flu infections. This is kind of interesting. Sheriff Joe is killing inmates. Veteran allegedly tasered until brain dead in Arpaio's Maricopa County. There's a lot of problems, I guess, with this guy. With all
isn't he the guy that put them in pink jumpsuits and made them be in the desert?
Arizona. Sheriff. Ernest Marty Atencio is a U.S. veteran who fought in the Gulf War and was the most patriotic guy on the planet, according to his brother in an interview with Phoenix New Times. Described as having special needs, Atencio was arrested after he kicked the door and confronted a stranger shortly before he became distracted by a passing vehicle and began chasing it, according to police report. In a booking photo, he was shown smiling, his eyes wide and leaning into the camera. He appears to be likely because his medication was not balanced, his brother told the paper.
So he was ill.
Yeah. Okay. So, but anyway, it is probable, had this case made its way through the system, that Mr. Atencio would have been found incompetent to stand trial or had been access to medical professionals who... to be put on the correct medications. We'll never know because Mr. Atencio was placed in one of Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio's infamous Maricopa County jails, and several hours later he was rushed to the hospital brain dead from excessive force. He'd been tasered and thrown back in his cell for 15 minutes before officers noticed he didn't have a pulse.
That's disgraceful.
Police brutality.
Let's go to the next one. That's enough of that.
Enough of that?
Yeah, that's horrible. Just horrible.
Yeah.
Guy is a ridiculous.
Yeah.
But, you know, cruel.
This one I thought was really good because this is something that nobody ever talks about. Right here. How we all pay for the huge tax privileges granted to religion. It's time to tax the church. We all are paying for the special privileges afforded to religion. Your taxes and mine have to be higher to make any revenue shortfall.
To make up the revenue shortfall.
That the government isn't taking in because these huge wealthy churches don't pay their own way.
By some estimates, the property tax exemption alone removes $100 billion in property from the U.S. tax rolls. And it's not just the big churches where the exemption bites. According to authors like Shikivu Hutchinson, the proliferation of small storefront churches is a major contributor to poverty and societal dysfunction in poor community. Since these churches remove valuable commercial property from the tax base and ensure that local governments remain cash-strapped and unable to provide basic services. Just about the only restriction that churches have to abide by in return is that they can't endorse political candidates. And even this trivial, easily evaded prohibition is routinely and flagrantly violated by the religious right. You got that right.
I think they should tax churches. I always thought they should.
Huh. We just have a couple more minutes, Leo.
Yeah. You want to... See where it's going here.
Well, it's not coming up.
It should. Come on, baby. Here we go.
Well, go ahead.
Here we go. The world would be a better place without religion. That was the topic of a recent debate in the NYU Intelligence Squared series. One of the audience questions concerned the enormous wealth hoarded by churches, which Christian apologist
Dinesh D'Souza
defended as follows. I think in the case of the Vatican, the wealth of the Vatican is in priceless treasures, tapestries, the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, art. Now, let's remember, it was popes, the Medici popes and so on, who commissioned those paintings. It wasn't for Catholicism. We wouldn't have, if it weren't, it wasn't for Catholicism, we wouldn't have the Sistine Chapel.
That was the only line of the night that got boos from the audience. It's easy to see why, since D'Souza was clearly trying hard to overlook the obvious reply. The reason it was the church that commissioned those artworks and not some other buyer is because the church had all the money. The great composers, painters, and sculptors of the Renaissance worked for whomever could afford to pay them, which is why they often ended up working for the church, even when they were notorious free thinkers, as in the case of Giuseppe Verdi. If it wasn't for Catholicism, we might not have the Sistine Chapel, but it's a near certainty that we would have had different artworks, equally majestic and famous by the same artist. As Richard Dawkins has suggested, wouldn't you love to hear Beethoven's Evolution Symphony? I bring this up because thanks to the Occupy protests, inequality has come to dominate the American political conversation. Poverty and inequality are the highest levels since the Great Depression, and there's a growing clamor to raise taxes on the wealthy to provide more opportunity for the rest of us. I think this is an excellent idea, and I'd like to suggest that besides Wall Street bankers and stock traders, there's another group of mega-wealthy that's often overlooked. And why don't we consider taxing the churches? And that's how that came up, what I read. And that...
And he goes into some that not all churches are rich and so on and so forth. But
then he talks about that.
Yeah. But you can check this out. It's kind of a long article.
Yeah.
But you can check this out at Alternate. Yep.
And I think it's an article worth reading. It's interesting.
Yeah, Alternate's a good...
And that seems like a well-written article. I think the way he's
Alternate sends good stuff to me.
Mm.
Awesome. Let's see.
We're right at the end of our show, Leo.
Yeah, we still got 1 minute here. Let's see if there's anything really affecting them with. Burn Egyptians in Hitler ovens, General said.
Retired Egyptian general says that protesters who came under attack by soldiers were delinquents who deserved to be thrown into Hitler's ovens. What a nice guy.
What a nice guy.
General Abdel Mounim Keito, who serves as advisor to the military's public relations department, made the remarks in an interview with the Egyptian newspaper Al-Sharuk on Monday. The invocation of Nazi Germany came just hours before Egypt's military rulers claimed to have foiled the plot to burn down the country's parliament building. The comment was strongly criticized by several Egyptian activists and politicians. Well,
no, that's the way they feel about it.
Now 9 o'clock, so
yeah.
We've come right to the end of our show, and I hope that we brought you some news that you wouldn't have heard of otherwise. I hope you appreciated some of the audios that we played. They were excellent, I thought. And
thank you so much for listening. And join me tomorrow night. Enter the fourth dimension.
Good night, folks.